Welkom bij een hele bijzondere aflevering van de Keto Podcast, een echte special edition. Ik neem je mee terug naar mei 2024. Toen had ik het grote voorrecht om samen met GoKeto CEO Ben Noordeman in de studio een bijzonder interview te doen. Het was de week dat het boek Heel je hoofd van Dr. Georgia Eid in het Nederlands verscheen en voor die gelegenheid nodigden we haar uit voor een live Lunch & Learn uitzending en ze zei ja. Het werd een waardevolle sessie waarin Georgia Eid haar Brain Healthy Diet Principles uitlegt en uitgebreid ingaat op de vele vragen die van tevoren waren ingezonden. Voor we starten nog een kleine noot. De geluidskwaliteit van deze opname wisselt. We hebben het zoveel mogelijk hersteld, maar het is niet helemaal wat je bent gewend van ons. Vind je dat storend? Luister dan via YouTube. Daar staat het hele interview met goede Engelse ondertitels en de link daarvoor vind je in de show notes. Dus, zit je klaar voor verrassende inzichten en een boeiend gesprek met deze bijzondere gast? Zet je koptelefoon op, schenk jezelf iets te drinken in en geniet van dit gesprek met Dr. Georgia Eid.
Welcome, it's 12:30, you're in the GoKeto studio. Warm welcome and a warm welcome to two of my very special guests. Before I introduce my guest of honor, another guest which you've already seen on our show before, it's Louisette Blikkenhorst. Louisette Blikkenhorst is the founder of Ketogene Institute in the Netherlands. She also has two education programs for professionals and for regular people like you and me.
Yeah.
Louisette, welcome.
Great to have you
on the show. Do you want to say a few words?
First of all, welcome everybody. I'm really thrilled to be here today with Georgia and with Ben. And we have many questions. So let's get started.
Okay, well, then please allow me to introduce Dr. Georgia Eid. Who is Dr. Georgia Eid? Dr. Georgia Eid is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist. She's world-renowned in the area of psychiatry, but also has over the last few years discovered and learned what nutrition does to our health and how those food choices affect our brain. I met Georgia 4 years ago at a keto conference in Switzerland. We've become friends over the years. And recently, Georgia has published a book. And we've already mentioned the book. The book is called Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind. Now, when I received this book, I thought, oh my God, this is too thick. And this is a scientist who wrote this. This is going to be too much. But as I was reading chapter by chapter, I thought, wow, she writes it down so clearly. She makes it so understandable and so fact-based that I thought, I got to get her into the studio. So I called Georgia up and said, Georgia, will you do an interview? Thinking that this was going to be online, you know, screen to screen. And Georgia said, I'm coming to Europe. I said, well, if you come to Europe, then you must come to our studio. So she's here in Holland. I'm really delighted to introduce you, Georgia Eid, and we will spend the afternoon, in the next hour and a half, to talk through her journey, what she has learned on nutrition and the brain, talk also about her experiences as a professional psychiatrist, how she does and what she does, and then in the end we'll briefly talk about the book, and then we'll open it up for questions. I think Louisette will probably spend about 45 minutes on introduction, and talking about all the facts and the science and everything else, and then we'll open it up for questions. Louisette, we have 100 questions, I think, already.
At least.
Anyone who's live in the audience right now, obviously put your hand up and we would love to have you on the show and ask you the question. So we're talking about Georgia Eid. Welcome, Georgia.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's really nice to be here with you and with Louisette, as I know both of you from meeting you in previous conferences, so it's great to be here together. And I'm looking forward to everybody's question.
Great.
Well, let's get started. I think we put up this slide. I just need to see if you can see it right now. So this is really what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about the most powerful way to change the brain is through food. And this is interesting because Dr. Georgia Eid has been a trained psychiatrist for many years and only discovered about food and nutrition on the brain recently, and we're going to be talking about that. Now, I need to go to the next slide, if I can. Just put it all directly on the slide. And these are Dr. Georgia's brain healthy diet principles. So in her book, you start, Georgia, saying what is important in nutrition. And what I really like is you don't start by saying, oh, you should have this diet or you should have that diet, but you take it the other way around. You say, okay, what is actually important for the brain? And you write that it, whatever nutrition we take, it has to nourish, it has to protect, and it has to energize. So I'd like with you, maybe you, we can zoom in on the protect, on the nourish part first, and say, okay, when you talk about nourish, what do you mean and what is the implications of that?
Right, so for any diet to be brain healthy, it has to do these three things: nourish, protect, and energize. And nourish means very simply that you have to eat a diet that provides the brain with all essential nutrients. So all the vitamins and minerals and building blocks that it needs to work properly. And so regardless of whether you're eating mostly plants or mostly animals or some mixture, that's the most important thing, is to make sure that the foods you're eating are capable, not only that they contain the nutrients that the brain needs, but that you can actually absorb those nutrients and deliver them to the brain. And so this is a very important difference, because there are some foods that contain nutrients, but you can't necessarily access them very easily. So nourishing the brain, if you look at the biology and the facts, if you're going to try to nourish your brain without including any supplements or fortified processed foods, you do need to include at least some animal food in the diet to make sure that you're getting all of the nutrients your brain needs. So that's the, or if you don't do that, you'll need to supplement very, very carefully, or include some fortified processed foods in your diet.
Do we know what the brain needs for nourishment? Do we have enough understanding of the brain to know what is necessary?
Yeah, so the brain is an organ, like every other organ in the body, requires all the same nutrients that every other cell in the body requires. So every, if it's essential, we know, we have a very clear understanding of what the essential nutrients are, which vitamins and which minerals we must consume in order to be healthy. And so the brain is no exception. In fact, there are certain nutrients the brain needs more of than the rest of the body, so or than most places in the body, because the brain, it needs to create electricity to work properly. It's an electrical organ that requires a tremendous amount of energy. And most of the vitamins and minerals that we get from our diet, most of what we need them for is to turn food into energy. So the brain needs to make more energy than most other organs. So it needs more of those vitamins and minerals than many of the other organs do. So it's very sensitive to nutrient deficiencies.
And those nutrients need to come from food, I guess, right? Or would you get them out of the air?
Well, you do need oxygen. You can't make energy without oxygen. You can breathe that in, but everything else, all we need is, we need food, mm-hmm. we need oxygen, we need sunlight, and we need water.
Okay. Okay. Now, this is about nourishment and about the nutrients that we needed. I'm just going to show the next slide, because you're also talking about protect the brain. Can you zoom in on that and tell us a bit more?
Yeah, so when I was training to be a psychiatrist back at the turn of the century now, back in the late 90s and early 2000s, I was trained, and I believe this is still the training, is that that mental health problems had two different types of root causes. They had the biological root causes and psychosocial root causes. So this was called the biopsychosocial model of root causes of mental illness. So the psychosocial causes, we were trained to think about things like stress and trauma.
So it was my mother.
And it did. Exactly. Right. And so I was trained to, if you come to me with problems from your childhood or your mother's, and I was trained to offer you psychotherapy, to have conversations and certain very special type of conversations to help work through those problems. But then I was also trained that the biological root causes of mental illnesses were things like the genes you were born with, or that would make you more vulnerable to chemical, what are called chemical imbalances in the brain. So these are imbalances in neurotransmitters, these communicating molecules in the brain, things like serotonin and dopamine. And I was trained to treat those root causes with medications. So most psychiatrists that I know and the way I was trained, we would offer medications and psychotherapy to our patients to try to help them improve. So, but now recently in the past 10 or 15 years, we understand, okay, what's beneath those chemical imbalances? What is causing those chemical imbalances in the first place, which we never really thought to think about before? And so some of the, we now are looking at, there are new branches of psychiatry that are looking at these newer root causes that are more, we're paying more attention to, which are inflammation of the brain,
mm-hmm.
something called oxidative stress, which is why we're always told we're supposed to eat so many antioxidants, and insulin resistance, or pre-diabetes, or high blood sugar and insulin levels. So these are the causes that we're paying more attention to now. And if you are looking for the root causes of those problems, so these are things that damage the brain from the inside out, you don't need to look any further than the modern industrialized so-called standard American diet, which is now everywhere in the world, including here in the Netherlands. You don't need to look any further than the diet, the modern industrialized diet, to find ingredients that directly cause inflammation, oxidative stress, and insulin resistance. So I think pretty much everybody agrees, lots of different types of nutrition professionals agree, that the so-called standard American diet or Western diet or industrial diet, we're just going to call it the SAD diet, standard, we're just going to call it SAD, that we all know that this is bad for us, for the body and for the brain, but so we all agree on that. But what we have a trouble agreeing on is what should we eat instead?
Yeah.
Like, what is the better diet for the brain, or what is even the best diet for the brain? And there's a lot of disagreement about that. So one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to take some of the confusion out of that question to help people understand which food choices make the most sense if you're trying to optimize your brain health.
Okay, so coming back, we're really talking about nourish, protect, and energize. Let's zoom into the energize, because you said that the brain is an energy processing machine. Is that a good way? No,
yes.
Maybe not. Or
it's an energy hog. It's very greedy. It wants lots of energy to make electricity. And if you're trying to make smooth, reliable, sustainable energy...
Sorry. Why does the brain need electricity?
Because for the cells to send messages to each other requires an electrical signal.
Okay.
Electrical. So for one cell to talk to the next cell, it uses electricity.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's a good question. So and energy takes a lot. You need so you need a lot of energy to make electricity. And if you want to make it smoothly and reliably and sustainably with the least amount of, there's some ways you can make energy that just are dirtier than others. They cause more inflammation, more oxidative stress. So if you, for example, if you try to nourish your brain 100% on sugar, carbohydrates, glucose, then that causes more inflammation and oxidative stress than if you at least make some of that energy from ketones, which come from fat. So the brain can burn a variety of different fuels, but its two favorite fuels are glucose and ketones. Glucose that comes from blood sugar, and ketones that come when we're burning fat. So the brain works best and makes energy most reliably if it's using a mixture of glucose and ketones, not glucose all the time. That puts too much stress on the brain. And so in order to keep that balance, so you're not so you're burning a mixture, what the best way to do this is to keep your glucose and insulin levels, your blood sugar and your blood insulin levels in a healthy range. And if you're doing that, you'll be causing a lot less damage and a lot less stress, and you'll be making energy in a more reliable way. If you're using a balance of these two.
Okay, you shared with us a slide, which I will share now. You can see it there on the screen. Just need to put the second camera on there. Mm-hmm. And then, now this was a picture which I have seen in a similar way, but for me, there were some things that were new. Can we start on the left? Can you explain on the left, what does this mean and how should I interpret that?
Yeah, I'm glad you picked this slide because I think this is a really interesting and powerful concept that will help people understand why it's important. You know, we think all the time about, I think most people think that glucose or sugar is the brain's favorite fuel. They think of it as the ideal fuel source for the brain. And then they think of ketones as only an emergency backup fuel, only for special circumstances where you might have a serious disease or some problem, or you're starving and you have no other choice. So, the truth is that that glucose is not the brain's favorite fuel. The brain, if you there've been wonderful experiments to show this, especially by Professor Stephen Quinane, who's a brain metabolism and aging expert in Canada. He has shown that if you give brain cells glucose, they will use the glucose for energy. If you then add some ketones, even if there's plenty of glucose there, the brain cell will choose on purpose to burn a mixture of glucose and ketones. Even if it has the option of burning 100% glucose, it will not do that. It on purpose pulls ketones in and burns a mixture of glucose and ketones. And the more ketones you give the cell, the brain cell, the more ketones it will pull in and use for energy. This is really important because so many people think of glucose as the best and the ideal source of fuel for the brain, but that's actually not true. So why would the brain choose to burn a mixture of ketones and glucose is because ketones burn more smoothly, more efficiently, and with a lot less inflammation and oxidative stress. So it's a cleaner source of fuel. So if you're eating a healthy diet, your blood sugar levels will be in a healthy range. The amount of insulin that you need to process that the carbohydrate in your diet will be in healthy range. And the glucose from your bloodstream will cross easily into the brain and provide fuel for the brain. So, and now the problem is if you're eating a diet that makes your blood sugar go too high, so if your blood sugar goes too high too often, if you're eating too many of the wrong carbohydrates too often, your blood sugar will run too high. And whenever your blood sugar goes too high, your brain sugar does also. So the higher the blood sugar, the higher the brain sugar. And so they are not identical, but they go up and down together like this. So now the problem is the brain does not want too much glucose. So if you have too much glucose in your blood, then you have too much glucose in your brain, and that extra glucose will literally stick and cause molecules and important components of brain cells to become all sticky and dysfunctional, and they're going to cause a lot of inflammation and oxidative stress. So high blood sugar will cause high brain sugar. High brain sugar will cause inflammation and oxidative stress. And those are some of the root causes of mental health problems that cause damage to the brain from the inside out.
So would you call it like glucose poisoning then, or?
Yes, glucose toxicity.
Okay.
Yes, it's called glucose toxicity or glucose poisoning. The brain actually keeps the glucose inside, the level inside the brain, about 80% lower than the blood sugar, because it doesn't need or want, and it can't tolerate too much glucose. So if you're eating in this wrong way with too many of the wrong carbohydrates too often, the brain glucose goes too high, and that excess glucose is physically damaging to the brain.
So if I hear you correctly, then that level of the glucose in the brain is always related to the glucose in the blood.
Yes,
but
they
just
rise
much,
and fall
they rise and fall.
Exactly.
So it's not that the brain protects itself and says, I've had enough glucose, it just continues to soak it up.
Yeah, I think the brain did not evolve to see the levels of glucose that we flood our systems with all day long now. It wasn't designed to take in large amounts of naked carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates like sugar and flour and cereals and fruit juice all day long. It was designed in a whole food environment where we had, we had plants and animals, we had fruits and starchy vegetables and meat and eggs and fish and things like that. It was not designed to see cookies and cakes and muffins and cereals and fruit juice all day long.
Yeah.
eight times party time a day. So coming back to your slide, and the left part, I knew that high glucose in the blood was also high glucose in the brain, but I didn't know that I learned that through your book and through your explanation. That's really, really good. Now, on the second part is the insulin, which is for many people something which is a little bit difficult to understand. Now, insulin is needed to basically process the glucose, right? To get the glucose into your cells. But what you're saying is when you have high blood glucose, and you would have, let me take the slide back, you would get also high insulin, huh? Because the insulin is needed to process the glucose, to put it simple. But then the insulin which you would need to get rid of the glucose actually goes lower in the brain, which kind of gives you the idea that the glucose poisoning or toxicity actually kind of double rises. Is that a right conclusion, or?
Yeah, there are two problems with the, if you're eating too many of the wrong carbohydrates too often, that cause two problems. One is the high blood sugar, which causes the high brain sugar, which causes the damage inside the brain. The glucose toxicity, that's one problem. The other problem, sorry. So the other problem is that if you're eating too many of the wrong carbohydrates too often, you'll need lots of insulin. Your body, your pancreas, will need to release an excessive amount of insulin to process all of that glucose. So the more glucose you eat, the more carbohydrate you eat, the more insulin you need to process the carbohydrate. So not only is your blood sugar going too high, but your blood insulin is also going too high. So you're getting spikes in glucose and spikes in insulin. The spikes in glucose will be reflected in the brain. So the higher the blood sugar, the higher the brain sugar. But it's the opposite, and this sounds very, it doesn't sound correct, but it is. It's upside down from what you would think. The higher your blood insulin goes, over time, the lower your brain insulin will be. So the brain needs, in order to burn glucose, it needs two things. It needs glucose, but it also needs insulin. So insulin, glucose crosses into the brain easily, no questions asked. The more glucose in the blood, the more glucose in the brain. With insulin, the problem is the opposite. The higher your blood insulin, the lower your brain insulin. Because as you become, the more insulin you make, the more resistant your body and brain become to it. So that it's just trying to protect itself from being overstimulated by too much insulin. So the cells, even the cells lining the what is called the blood-brain barrier, that decides the blood-brain barrier separates the rest of your circulation from the inside of the brain to protect it from any risky substances that might be in the blood. So there are receptors, insulin receptors, on the surface of the brain, this blood-brain barrier, that you need to carry the insulin into the brain. And those receptors become insulin resistant. Mm-hmm. So it becomes harder and harder for insulin to cross into your brain. So over time, this sounds upside down, but the more sugary your diet is, the harder it becomes for your brain to use that sugar for energy, because the brain can't turn glucose into energy or anything else that it might need it for. It can't process glucose properly without adequate insulin. So you need both glucose and insulin to run your brain smoothly on glucose. So what you have, if you're eating the wrong way, which most people are eating six times a day refined carbohydrates, what you have is your brain can be swimming in a sea of glucose, but still slowly be starving to death.
Is that something, Louisette, that you recognize? Because insulin resistance is a lot of what you do. Do you want to comment on that maybe? Because insulin resistance is for many people not an easy thing to understand.
Yeah, sure.
Do you want to comment on that maybe?
It's a bit like when I come from a background where we play lots of heavy metal music. So if you don't like heavy metal, that it might overpower you. So after a while, when of hearing all the heavy metal too much, too many times, you just cover your ears and you don't want to hear it anymore. That's what cells do as well. They get too many times per day the insulin, and they're overpowered by it. They don't react anymore. They turn deaf for the message of insulin, and that's when they become resistant. So it's not the pancreas producing less insulin, perhaps even more. But the cell has shut down the door, covered his ears, doesn't listen anymore, and that's when insulin resistance
Would you say
occurs.
That's also the case because the cell is already full of glucose and says, I don't want it anymore? Isn't the door closing also because of that?
I think so, yes. When the cell is full of glucose, it doesn't enter anymore, but the body has a plan B for the leftover glucose that's not let into the cell. It's being brought to the liver, and that's where the liver turns into fat and stores it right here on your love handles.
That's exactly right. If you eat more carbohydrate than your metabolism can handle, every extra molecule of carbohydrate that you eat that's too much, your liver will turn it into saturated fat on purpose and store it in your body. So you can eat a fat-free diet. Everybody knows this. Yeah. Everybody knows somebody who eats a fat-free diet who has too much body fat. You don't need to eat any fat to become fat. All you need is too much glucose. And when your insulin levels are high, which they will be if you're eating too much carbohydrate, the high insulin turns your fat storage on. It tells your body, turn this glucose into fat and store it. So that's really important.
Okay, so we should be looking at sugar as being the culprit and not fat.
Yes.
Being the culprit. Okay, let's go back to the picture because I do think it's worthwhile to look at that once more. So to summarize, if I eat a diet that is high in blood glucose, then my brain glucose will in a way mimic that, right, in a lower percentage. But the insulin, which is needed by the cells to process the glucose, will actually lower in the brain. So there will be more glucose floating around in the brain, right?
What you'll end up with is a high glucose, low insulin brain. So too much glucose means you'll have the glucose toxicity causing the inflammation and the oxidative stress, which physically damaged the brain. And you won't have enough insulin to use the glucose to full capacity or properly. So your brain will start to run low on energy. And if the brain can't make enough energy reliably around the clock, all kinds of things can go wrong. And which things go wrong is going to depend on who you are, what your genetic background is, what your family history is, what your, you know, all of the other things that have already happened to you in your life. That's what's the difference. Some people may develop Alzheimer's disease, some people may develop type 2 diabetes, some people may develop obesity or fatty liver disease, cancers. What happens to you is that's related to your genetics, but it's really mostly, you can protect yourself from most of these things happening to you if you have the right information about nutrition and eat in a different way.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I brought up the second slide. Can you talk to that? Maybe again, starting on the left and starting on a diet which is much lower in glucose.
Right. So if you're eating a diet that's too high in carbohydrate for your metabolism, especially if it's too much refined carbohydrate, the sugars, the flours, the fruit juices, the cereals, the naked carbohydrates, those are going to give you excessive spikes in blood sugar, glucose, and therefore excessive spikes in brain sugar. So the higher your blood sugar, the higher your brain sugar. When that happens, that's going to give you, that's going to over time because the high insulin levels are causing the insulin resistance or the brain to start go deaf or numb to the insulin. So you have a high glucose brain, a low insulin brain, and that's your brain metabolism is going to start to become sluggish. So if you have insulin resistance or prediabetes, then, and you have some insulin resistance, what happens is the brain starts to run low on energy, sluggish brain metabolism. By the time you notice any memory problems, for example, you can already have lost 25% of your brain's glucose processing capacity.
I thought this was just part of getting older, but it sounds like there's something we can do about it.
There's a lot you can do about it. Yeah.
Now, one of the things which you mentioned in your book, which I guess is on the right side of the slide, tell us what that means. So you would lower your carbohydrates and turn your body into a fat burning mode. And then what happens?
Yeah, so on the left, you have the high carbohydrate diet, which is the high glucose, high insulin diet. And that leads to the high glucose, low insulin brain, low energy brain. If you switch to a ketogenic diet, what you're doing on a ketogenic diet is you're lowering your insulin levels. You're making changes to your lifestyle to bring insulin levels down. And when you bring the insulin level down to a certain point, your body will start to turn on fat burning. Remember, if insulin is high, you're storing fat, you're making fat. When insulin is low, you turn the fat burning on. The only way you can burn fat is if your insulin level is below a certain point. You switch into fat burning, and if you're burning fat vigorously, some of that fat, the liver will turn into ketones, which are just very short little fragments of fat that are easy. They can cross the blood-brain barrier and enter the brain easily and be burned for energy that can bridge that energy gap from that sluggish brain glucose processing that's caused by insulin resistance. So the ketogenic diet is a godsend. It's a perfect solution for someone who has trouble burn, their brain can no longer burn glucose at full capacity anymore. And that's most of us because, or at least in the United States, it's most of us, because insulin resistance is now, most of us in the United States now have insulin resistance. That means our brains aren't functioning at full capacity. When you switch to a ketogenic diet, you bridge that energy gap. And that sometimes often, you know, people will say even within 3 days of starting a ketogenic diet that they suddenly feel this tremendous mental clarity, better concentration, better mood, better mental energy. They get more things done. They feel really different. It's a different state of mind.
Yeah, I think we have that right from all the clients, lifting brain fog.
Yes.
More energy.
Yes, that's the common effect that most people report, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm just going to summarize here and bring the slide back up. So we have spoken about the rules for brain food. It should nourish, it should protect, and it should energize. Now, you have included some recommendations, Georgia,
yeah,
as to what type of foods would actually do that. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so to nourish the brain, again, if you're using only whole foods and no supplements or fortified processed foods, I think ideally for most people, this is going to be a diet of whole plant and animal foods. It must include at least some animal food in the diet in order to get all your nutrients, because there are some nutrients, quite a few actually, that are very difficult to obtain from plant foods, if not impossible in some cases to obtain from plant foods. And so plants have some nutrient holes so it's very, very important to include some animal foods if you're willing to do that. So nourish the, and also I recommend avoiding the grains and the legumes, because even though we're told that that should be the basis of a healthy diet, they are very low in nutrients and they are very high in anti-nutrients, which make it hard for us to access some of the nutrients that they do contain.
What is an anti-nutrient?
Yeah, so an anti-nutrient is some plant foods, they guard their nutrients for their own selfish purposes with anti-nutrients. So that, so for example, a really good example is the grains and the beans. So the grains and the beans, they inside a grain, every grain and bean is a little baby plant, a little embryo. You can see inside, if you cut it in half, there's a little embryo there, once ready to sprout, right? Well, the nutrients are for that baby plant. And so the seeds hold on to those nutrients using anti-nutrients. So they guard their nutrients and make it harder for us to access them, because they really, they're not for us, they're for the sprouting plant to come in the future. So a very good example is phytic acid or phytate. This is a mineral magnet that seeds, that grains and legumes especially, contain, that make it very difficult for us to access calcium, magnesium, iron, and zinc that are inside that food.
So you mean to say that even though these are inside the food, that as a human being, I can't access them because of these anti-nutrients?
Right. So this is a very little known nutrition secret, is that just because a plant food contains a nutrient does not necessarily mean that you can access it. So you can see it on the nutrition label, but that doesn't mean it's going to make it to the brain.
Yeah, great.
So avoid grains and legumes. What are legumes is not a word that we use a lot in Europe. What is your definition of legumes? Because legumes is the French word for vegetable as a whole.
Right.
So what do you call legumes?
Yeah, so peas, beans, and lentils.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the slide. So we've talked about now animal foods. Why are they so superior? Why in your mind are they superior?
Well, only animal foods contain every nutrient we need in its proper form. And when we're talking about meat, seafood, and poultry, without any anti-nutrients or defensive toxins, because plants also protect themselves with defensive toxins. So meat is the safest, most nutritious meat, seafood, poultry. When I say meat, seafood, and poultry, these are the most nutritious and also, strangely enough, I know it doesn't sound correct because that's not what we hear, but not only the most nutritious, but also the safest food group we can eat.
Okay, now protect, tell us, refined carbohydrates and vegetable oils in ultra-processed foods. What is the problem there?
Yeah, so the signature ingredients of this, the so-called SAD diet, sometimes people will say that the reason why modern diets are bad for us is because they contain too much red meat and too much saturated fat. And that's absolutely not true. Those ingredients have been in the human diet for hundreds of thousands of years. So the new things that make this modern diet so dangerous than every other diet that ever came before it are the refined carbohydrates, meaning high quantities of these naked carbohydrates, sugars and flours and cereal products that you can only really make in any significant quantity using a factory, industrial methods, and refined vegetable oils. These are the seed oils. These come from soybean oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil, canola oil. These are the so-called vegetable oils, and these also you can only create using a factory or an oil refinery. So these are not natural. These don't belong in the human diet. And these are just about every ultra-processed food you see in the supermarket contains refined carbohydrates, vegetable oils, or both. And these directly cause inflammation in the brain and excessive oxidative stress in the brain. These free radicals that are like very damaging to the brain's structure. And the high refined carbohydrate is what can lead to the insulin resistance that we were just talking about. So those three root causes, the inflammation, oxidative stress, and insulin resistance, can all come from the signature ingredients of the modern ultra-processed diet.
All right, we actually agreed, George and I, this morning that we're going to do a supermarket challenge. We're going to try and fill up a shopping cart in the supermarket with things that would actually be brain healthy in some form or way. We're going to see how full the cart can get, if we can get it full at all. But that's going to be interesting. So just to summarize, I think I'll put the slide here. So a healthy human diet should really nourish. And I think you made your case for animal foods being so important, and also the concerns about plant foods. To protect includes the exclude the refined carbohydrates and refined oils, and to energize. Now, before we go into the questions, I think I want to share the title of the book, which is in English and which is coming out on Wednesday in Dutch. For alle Nederlanders, you kunt het bestellen, woensdag komt het uit. And just to briefly summarize the book, tell us there's four chapters, right? You want to just briefly share with us how the buildup of the book is?
Yeah, so four sections to the book, and I'm really excited that it's being translated into Dutch. This is the first foreign language it's being translated into. Heel je hoofd.
Heel je hoofd.
And so this is so there are four sections to the book. So the first section is rethinking brain food. So this is really helping people understand why so many of the recommendations that we're talking about today go against most of the information that we are accustomed to hearing. So help show people where that information comes from and why you can't trust that information and why it's actually causing you much more harm than good. So we talk about that. And then we talk about psychiatry and the history of how we got to this. How do we get to this problem in nutrition and the problems in psychiatry? So how did we get here? And then, then we wipe the slate clean with all the bad information, and then we start with the real information that actually works to help people. So part two shows how the modern diet, the modern industrialized diet, causes problems for the brain. How it destabilizes, causes these chemical imbalances in the brain. Energy imbalances in the brain, hormonal imbalances throughout the brain and body that can cause a lot of psychiatric symptoms. So we go through all of that, like why the modern diet is so damaging to the brain. And then in part three, we look at all the different food groups so you can explore for yourself the pluses and minuses of every food group that you are interested in. So you can look at the grains and the beans, you can look at meat and seafood, you can look at dairy, you can look at eggs, you can look at fruits and vegetables, and you can see the real risks and benefits of those food groups, not the ones you're used to hearing about. And so that you can make your own informed choices about what you want to eat with the real information. And then the fourth part is actually suggested plans. So especially if you're looking for better mental health, but really the principles apply to every health problem, because the brain does not need a different diet than the rest of the body. You can't eat a different diet for every different organ in your body. It doesn't make any sense. So the same rules for your whole body and your brain. And so there are several different dietary plans for you to choose from. And it's not just ketogenic. So there's ketogenic is one option, but I know that not everybody wants to eat a ketogenic diet, and then not everybody needs to eat a ketogenic diet. Depends on your personal metabolism and your goals. So there are other choices in the book, including what I call a quiet paleo diet. And this is just whole plant and animal foods, but it's been modified a little bit to make it a little safer, a little easier to digest, a little gentler on your system. So there's a quiet paleo plan, a quiet keto plan, and even a quiet carnivore plan for people who don't get enough relief from trying a ketogenic plan. And these are really just experiments for you to see, you know, 6 to 12 weeks to see what's possible for you. And then you can maybe try expanding your diet after that if you want to. But I explain exactly how to do this in the book if you want to try to change your diet to improve your mental health.
Now, you've been practicing this in your psychiatry practice. What are the results? Because I think I really want to thank you for sharing this very scientific, fact-based approach. But of course, everyone will want to know, does this work? Well, because the science is one, but what is the experience so far? Because I got very, very worried reading in your book that so many students at the university also already take, I don't know, what did you say, 1 in 3, 1 in 6? What was it, medications?
Yeah, you know, nearly a billion people on the planet now have a mental health condition so serious that it's interfering with their ability to function. And that includes 1 in 5 of the world's children and adolescents, which is, yeah. And in the United States, we can see a very clear trend, and this is happening in other countries as well, that we're moving in the wrong direction. It's not just that the situation is very dismal already, it's that it's getting worse. And so, for example, in the United States, if you look at all adults, you see that about 1 in 4 adults are suffering with a mental health disorder. But among the young adults, 18 to 25, it's 1 in 3. And so, and about 1 in 5 Americans takes at least one psychiatric medication. And you know, so things are getting worse, and we just cannot medicate our way out of this problem. The medications, they have their place, and I still use them, and they can be very helpful in some cases. But the truth is, they do fail most people. They don't bring enough people meaningful relief. We have to find a different way forward because this is not sustainable.
And the way you found was with diet, change your diet, change your mind. What are experiences with your patients or clients or students, whatever you call them?
Right. So the reason I wrote the book is because diet, I from practicing this way for so many years now, I have a clear, and compared to how I used to practice with just medications and psychotherapy, these are the most powerful tools I have available to me to help people, almost regardless of the diagnosis or how long someone has been ill or how many medications they're taking. Because these interventions make biological sense and they improve total brain health. So when you improve total brain health, it doesn't matter what the diagnosis is. It's very likely going to help you. And that's what we see in clinical practice. I mean, I've seen hundreds of patients over the last, however long I've been doing this, 10, 12 years, and with all different kinds of conditions, psychiatric conditions, from, you know, anxiety and attention deficit disorder to post-traumatic stress disorder to depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, Alzheimer's disease. Because I'm a general psychiatrist, I don't specialize in anything. So I see everybody who comes to see me. And I used to say that I could just count on one hand. And now, after all these years, I'd say less than two hands, the number of people who have not improved substantially in meaningful ways within, I know this sounds ridiculous. I know it doesn't sound true. Days to weeks of changing their diet in the correct ways. It's profound. I mean, it's a very powerful tool.
I don't even know what to say, you know, because we know this from experience, but I know that lots of people are very skeptic about it. How can it be so quickly? How can it be so fast?
Yeah.
But we see this every day. You see it in our practice. We see it also with our clients and with all the other health practitioners that we work with, that this change in diet has such a profound effect and so quickly. On the one hand, it's surprising. On the other hand, you know, if you take a bottle of gin and you drink it, we're not surprised that we would get drunk. And if we drink too much, we're not so surprised that it might have an immediate effect within 1 or 2 hours. And we're surprised that changing our diet will all of a sudden change our mind in a positive way.
Yeah. We wouldn't be surprised if that person stopped drinking if they started to feel better relatively quickly.
Yeah,
that would also be possible. Yeah. Now, you went out of your way, out of your psychiatry education, all of that, to basically open a new field and take a new approach. How did you get into that in the first place?
Completely by accident. And I think, like a lot of so-called alternative healthcare practitioners, which I hope we will gradually become the mainstream way of practicing, I think, like a lot of other people, it was through my own selfish health issues that I was trying to solve my own health problems. So I was just getting creative and trying to do something to help myself. I had, in my early 40s, which is now about 20 years ago now, I started developing all these mysterious problems that a lot of my patients had, especially my middle-aged and older patients. So chronic pain, which they called fibromyalgia, and all these digestive issues, which they called IBS, and I have migraine headaches and fatigue, and it was starting to become really difficult to work. And so I went and saw this Harvard specialist, because I was working at Harvard at the time, so I had access to lots of great people, very smart, very caring specialist, and they all, and I would kind of test, and they said, oh, everything looks great, everything's normal. Well, of course it wasn't normal, but there just weren't any tests for what was going on. And I think this is true for a lot of people. We don't have tests for these things. So, you know, and they all sent me home with the same advice about what to eat, the low fat, low cholesterol, high fiber diet. And I was already eating that way. I've been eating that way for years. And so in any case, they couldn't find anything wrong. So what was I going to do? So I just started, because part of the symptoms had to do with digestion, discomfort and so forth. I said, well, maybe something I'm eating is causing this digestive problem, right? So I'm going to start experimenting with my diet and see if I can figure out what's bothering my stomach. So I just started this process of keeping a food and symptom journal to try to figure out what's going on. Long story short, after 6 months of making these changes and writing everything down, everything was better. Everything, the migraines were gone, the fibromyalgia was gone, the fatigue was gone, the IBS symptoms, the digestion were all solved, which was amazing. But even more interesting to me as a psychiatrist was my mood was better, my energy was better, my concentration was better, my sleep was better, my anxiety was better. And I was like, well, this diet seems to be good for the brain. I wasn't even trying to help my brain. I didn't even know there was anything that wrong with my brain to be. I think most people have come to expect very little. They think, you know, it's normal to be easily irritated or to have mood swings or to have trouble sleeping or to be, you know, to be really unstable or to have a lot of, have trouble dealing with stress or recovering from a stressful situation or to run out of mental energy in the middle of the day. Those kinds of things, but those things are not normal. You know, your brain, if you feed it properly, will work for you all morning, afternoon, and evening for the rest of your life. And so this is not what we've come to expect. So that's how I got interested, was I thought, well, this diet, which was very upside down from what we were told to eat.
Because you write in your book that at some point you even went meat only?
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
But that's scary, right? You get a heart attack, you get cancer, you get...
I'm suffering as a result. I think my life has been shortened by 20 years, at least. I experimented for 8.5 months with only meat, seafood, poultry, and water and salt. No caffeine, no plants, no spices, nothing. And for most of the past 15 or more years, I've been eating a mostly animal diet with very small amount of plant foods. And this is mainly because of my food sensitivities. I don't necessarily think everybody needs to eat this way, but one of the reasons why I included a carnivore option in the book is because for some of us who have developed a lot of breakdown of our natural defensive systems, that we should be able to tolerate a wide variety of foods. Some of us have had those systems break down over time, and we need sometimes, at least for a small, for a period of time, to take a break from high plant food intake. And it works very well for some people as a temporary or sometimes even longer elimination strategy.
So if you want to know more, you'll read in the book the difference between red meat and white meat, which is actually very, very little. And more of those things, but let's move on. Also for the sake of time, I think I'd like to give the microphone to Louisette.
Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah, we will. Questions? We will.
Oh,
we will.
Yes.
No, the questions are coming now.
Oh, okay.
You mean questions from the chat?
Yeah, there are also some questions.
Yeah, we'll answer. But first, I'd like to give the word to Louisette, and
yes.
as a small message, because I'm not sure if we'll have time at the end. I just wanted to share with you that Louisette, as already mentioned, is the founder of Ketogene Instituut Nederland. She is, for me, an amazing person. I took my program there keto therapist. She does a program both for professionals as well as for consumers. And because of everything around mental health, you have also created a specific program for that. Can you just, before we move into
yes.
questions, can you talk 1 minute on that?
Yes.
Right over there.
Okay, well, I'm very proud to announce that we're starting a metabolic mental health training. I'm doing this together with Nicole Laurent. She is already doing this in the United States. And well, we met last year in Switzerland and agreed to work together. And we're currently working on translating it, making it fitting for the Dutch population and Belgian and everybody who speaks Dutch. And well, it's not ready yet. We're still working on it. So we're doing a small pre-launch today. The course is meant for everyone working in the mental health field. Perhaps you can go to the next slide.
Oh, sorry.
Then you can. from psychiatrists, psychologists. In Dutch, we call that GGZ-medewerkers. But also for anyone experienced as a keto professional who wants to focus their knowledge and their skills into cooperation with the mental health professionals, because I understand that not every mental health professional has the time or the energy to coach people themselves or to do a training. So we're looking to start a network, to build a network of keto professionals, mental health professionals.
I think it's fantastic news.
Yes.
And I think, Georgia, you can be so proud of what you have initiated. And you see how it resonates. There's some people in the audience here, also from Leiden University, who are actually also active in that field. So really exciting about what's happening and so on.
Yes.
Now we're going to go to the questions. We
yes.
have questions from the audience as well. I think we will, since they're here, we'll start with those. Kira, can you help us here?
Some questions. So yes, we talked about oil for a bit. So some people ask, like, what are the right oils to use? And especially they say olive oil, cumin oil, and Nigella oil, if I say it right.
Nigella.
Nigella oil, yeah. So those are the questions. So for both of you,
I don't know those oils, so.
Nigella, is it like a black seed, little small black seed?
Oh,
it's a black seed. But I'm not sure, I hardly ever use it. Perhaps in other countries.
What are the better oils and what are the oils to avoid?
So, you know, we're taught to think about, we've been taught for a long time to think about bad fats as saturated fats and good fats as unsaturated fats. We really need to start to focus on is refined fats versus fats from whole foods. That's the big line to draw. And so we want the minimally processed fats, and that can come from plants or animals. So it can come from, you know, it can come from beef, or it can come from pork, or it can come from duck.
Yeah.
Or you can have the unrefined oils from plant foods, particularly olive oil, avocado oil, coconut oil. These are some of the healthier choices you can make, are the unrefined, the minimally processed fats from plant, whole plant and animal foods, not the refined fats that come from factories.
Okay, thank you so much. There was another question, and which is talking about dairy. You know, you have dairy, you have defatted dairy, full fat dairy, you see a lot of kefir nowadays and so on. And there's lots of talks about that being extremely healthy, and other people saying, well, dairy has only been part of the human diet for such a short time. Could you maybe answer that question?
Yeah, so this is where I get pretty unpopular. because dairy foods, there are pros and cons to dairy. And so in the book, I've gone into a lot of detail about the pluses and minuses of dairy. So one of the pluses, for example, is that it's very versatile. It's very delicious. It's convenient. You can find it just about everywhere. And it's nutritious. It contains a lot of really important nutrients. And most dairy products are naturally very low in carbohydrate, if not carbohydrate free. So they're really nice choices for a ketogenic diet. But there are also some downsides to dairy, and some of us do better with dairy than others, and some of us do better with certain dairy products than others. It's really the most complicated food group on the planet. And so what I've done in the books, try to help people understand some of the pros and cons. So we talked about some of the pros. One of the cons is that dairy is, it's a species-specific growth formula for a baby mammal. So in most cases, it's a cow, but it could be something else like a sheep. And it's really designed for rapid growth to turn that baby cow into a much bigger cow very quickly. So it's designed to stimulate growth hormone systems in mammals, and it does the same thing to us. So you have to be aware of that, because some people will gain unwanted weight on dairy, or feel very hungry all the time on dairy, or even feel addicted to dairy foods. And it can be very inflammatory for some people, hard to digest, or cause skin issues, or headaches, or chronic pain, inflammation. Mm-hmm. So everybody's a little different. So I really encourage people in the book to experiment with this food group if they're not feeling their best. If you include dairy and you feel well, okay. I wish that were me. but if you don't, do some experiment, get curious and do some experimentation, see how you feel.
The unprocessed dairy is maybe low in glucose and carbohydrates, but any fruit yogurt or whatever, there's more sugar or sugary substances added than the original product. So be aware of that. Louisette.
Yes, we've had many questions beforehand. And what speaks to me the most, what strikes me the most, is that many people still have some degree of disbelief. And how can this help me? I have a question here from Domenico, and he says, I was on a keto diet. Most people talk about keto diets here. Mm-hmm. And I felt really well, physically and mentally. I figured it out myself by reading books. And I've found that I really feel physically better and mentally better. But I can't find any studies on why it makes me feel better. Could you tell us in a few words? I mean, you've already described a lot in this, this session. But could you say in a few words why it helped him, making him feel better?
Yeah, so the ketogenic diet is so much more powerful than any medication. Medications are designed usually to do one thing. They're usually designed to interfere with one particular aspect of human biology. A ketogenic diet, I sometimes describe it as a multi-purpose tool, because what it's really doing is, because you're changing the way the brain gets energy, makes energy, all of the pathways in the brain change. And so really what you're doing is you're changing the brain's operating system. You're not just changing one neurotransmitter or one chemical or one part of the brain, just the depression part or just the anxiety, but the brain isn't divided like that. So it's a whole organ, and it functions together, and it needs the right mix of fuels. And when you eat this way, the whole brain changes the way it does business, so that you will then have, your brain can work optimally, not just kind of get by sometimes doing the best it can. So it's a really powerful intervention. It reduces inflammation, it reduces oxidative stress, it bridges that energy gap. So and if you make it of the right foods, because it doesn't just need ketones, the brain also needs the right nutrients. If you've designed your ketogenic diet to be nutritious, then you're nourishing and protecting and energizing the brain, all three. And people feel really well when they address all of those pieces.
Yes, great. Another question that pops up is age. there's one lady here asking, which brain food would you recommend for school children or students?
Oh, okay. So I'm not a child psychiatrist. I don't work with teenagers or children. But I work with a lot of parents, and they always ask me, you know, what should I feed my children for better mental health? And I say, I would always start by recommending a so-called paleo diet first, mainly just whole plant and animal foods, minimally processed, you know, meat and seafood and poultry and eggs and nuts and, and seeds and so forth. And just, you know, keeping out the grains, the legumes, the added sugars, the ultra processed foods, the vegetable oils, all the modern, all the cereals that we think, you know, children are supposed to eat lots of cereal all day, and that's just not good for kids. It's just mostly, body just sees it as sugar. So more nutritious, kind of whole foods diet, that's what I recommend. And if that doesn't work, they may then need to see a specialist who might maybe take a look at a lower carbohydrate or even ketogenic diet for children. But I really think the best first step is just to eat a whole foods diet that makes biological sense.
Yes, agreed.
I thought the best way to start was just an energy drink, right? Maybe not.
With lots of caffeine, yeah. On the other hand, I have a question from Natalie saying, what's your view on cognitive disorders like autism, ADD, ADHD, and Alzheimer's, and do you think that people can still heal their brain with food even at a later age?
Yes, I have many good examples of this. I put one example in the book, and I'm also going to tell about my mother. So the one example in the book is a woman named Fran, who was very gracious in sharing her story for the book. And she had for almost 20 years something called mild cognitive impairment, which is kind of a pre-Alzheimer's disease, where some difficulty with memory, things like losing her car in parking lots and that sort of thing. And she eventually had to leave her job as a pharmaceutical sales representative because she was having so much difficulty managing her work obligations. So then, as she entered her early 60s, she started to have a decline in her mental function. So she'd been sewing, using a sewing machine to make clothing almost every day for 50 years. She had the sewing machine her mother had given her. And she sat down one day to try to use it, and she couldn't remember how to put the thread through the machine. And she got really scared. And so she went to her doctor and said, "My memory's getting worse." And he said, "Oh, you know, we knew this was going to happen because you already were on this path. So this is early Alzheimer's, and I want you to, you know, I'll make an appointment with a neurologist for, you know, he doesn't have anything for 10 weeks, but I'll make this appointment so that you can see if this is the diagnosis." So so during that time, she her son was already working with me. So we I advised her that she could try a ketogenic diet while she was waiting for her appointment with the neurologist. And within 3 weeks, her cognition started to noticeably improve. She was able to remember, you know, how to thread her machine, use her sewing machine. She could find her car in parking lot. She could remember driving directions, all these things. She didn't just get a little bit better back to a few months before. She was better than she'd been in many, many years. And that was her late 60s. My mother just turned 90 years old last summer. And when she was on her way to her 90th birthday, about a year and a half ago, January 2023, she started a low carbohydrate diet because she was having a lot of health issues, you know, difficulty concentrating and neck pain and headaches and dizziness and sleep problems and depression. And so she started a low carbohydrate diet and within weeks improved dramatically. And I am able to be here in Europe this summer, even though I didn't think I was going to be able to, given how poorly she was doing last year, because I thought I wouldn't be able to travel because she'd need so much support and help. She's home, she's driving, she's taking care of people, she's going grocery shopping, she's paying her bills. I mean, she, it's
and
never
she told you,
late.
Right? She told you, said, "Georgia, you got to go out there.
Go, stop complaining, go."
Yeah.
She's thriving. It's never too late.
Never too late.
Never too late.
And the ketogenic diet or with food, you can achieve much more than with medication alone.
Changing your diet in the correct ways is can bring you benefits that no medicine is capable of.
Yes, and those are also questions on this topic. For example, here I have a pharmacist. Ellen says, "I'm a pharmacist with a passion for health lifestyle. Which medication could be possibly de-prescribe, with a physician of course, when people start eating keto, and how long after start is it safe to do so, if at all?"
Yeah, so if we're talking about psychiatric medicines and a ketogenic diet, what I teach in my training programs, I teach clinicians how to safely incorporate ketogenic diets into the care of people with mental health conditions. And the reason why we need a course like that, why you shouldn't just jump right onto a ketogenic diet if you're taking any prescription medications or have any pre-existing health conditions, is because the ketogenic diet is a powerful intervention. It's not like other diets. It's a powerful biochemical and metabolic intervention. It can change your blood sugar, your blood pressure, your insulin levels, and the medication, the medication levels in your blood. It can change lots of things in your body, in your physiology, sometimes even within 24 hours. So you need to work with somebody who is able to monitor and keep you safe when you're adjusting to the diet. The diet is safe. It's the combination of the diet with these other conditions that can make it a little complicated. And also, if you're eating a very unhealthy diet and you suddenly drop your your blood sugar levels and insulin levels very quickly from a very junky diet to a very squeaky, clean, ketogenic diet in one day, that's a huge shock to your brain and your body. So you don't want to do that. So in the book, I advise people to ease into it. But what I teach people and the clinicians in my training program is that we usually don't make any medication changes until about week three, but then the earliest that we would start to think about it. And I only change them during week three if I notice that there's a problem and they need to be changed. Otherwise, I'd like to wait a good 12 weeks before I even start thinking about lowering the medicines, because you need your brain and your body to settle into this new equilibrium. Everything's changing when you're switching your operating system over your metabolic pathways. Give your brain and body time to adjust and get efficient at turning ketones and fat into energy, because those pathways have been very sleepy. You haven't been using them often enough for them to work properly. So that's so medication depends on the medicine, depends on the person. There's no one right answer. But I'd like, if I can, to wait at least 12 weeks.
I'd like to make maybe one comment to that, because we're really talking about psychiatric drugs.
Yeah.
Because if you're taking things like blood pressure or anything related to that area, because if you change from burning glucose and carbohydrates to fat, your metabolism changes so quickly, you have to monitor.
Yes.
If you're taking diabetes drugs and so on, you have to monitor. You cannot wait 8 weeks.
No.
You have to adjust much quicker. So I just wanted to, for clarity's sake, make clear that psychiatric drugs are obviously in a different area than the drugs that are related to diabetes, insulin resistance, blood pressure, blood thinning medication, and so on. So there, for those people that do consider changing their diet, make sure that you monitor those much more closely, because things will start changing within a couple of days.
Yes.
That's a really important point, because if you there are practitioners with lots of experience, like Dr. Eric Westman, who's been studying low carbohydrate diets for many, many years. He will, if he's working with somebody who's taking insulin, he cuts their insulin dose in half on day one.
Wow.
Because he knows that if he doesn't do that, the ketogenic diet is so good at lowering blood sugar that you don't need nearly as much medicine as you used to even the previous day.
Yeah.
To keep your blood sugar in a healthy range.
Wow.
This
amazing.
This is maybe also good to add, because I think there was a question right from the audience that said, okay, how does this work? How can I get more energy? And I think the point that you showed in the slide, where it says that high glucose means relatively high glucose in the brain to that percentage, but then lower insulin, which means lower energy to the brain. And the biggest thing that happens when you switch from burning carbs to burning fat and producing ketones is that you turn that energy source back on. And that's where you, I don't know, there was a question, right, Kira, from how does it work, is that is the biggest thing that works. And we sometimes get questions, people saying, okay, but if keto can do all that, is then keto the magic solution to everything?
Yeah.
And actually, it is and it is not. It's not a magic solution, but the basis of whether that is diabetes, insulin, diabetes, overweight, obesity, cancer, the many, many of our Western diseases all come back to a similar cause. And the cause is that there is a metabolic health issue and that there's a fact of an overexposure to glucose and this so-called insulin resistance or this overcalled glucose toxicity. And there's many different ways that you can do to actually heal that, cure that, change that, and get back into a healthy metabolic state. The reason why keto is so interesting, because as we heard and as we all know from those people that are operating in the field, is that it is a very powerful way of doing that in a number of weeks. So yes, you can improve your metabolic health with many different diets, with many different changes, but keto is one that resolves it very quickly. And many of the Western diseases today, or the majority, I would say the vast majority, is caused by this metabolic unhealthy situation that we are mostly in, unfortunately, due to the poor food that we have on our tables.
Yes. Do we have some more time for a question?
I think the questions, yeah.
Yes, okay.
In the question, there were lots of questions about microbiome, right?
Microbiome, yes. Also about vegan diets. There are several here. People asking, is it possible to eat a vegan ketogenic diet or brain healthy diet?
It is. So the good news is that ketogenic, anybody can get the benefits of ketosis, of burning more fat for energy, regardless of your dietary preferences. It's more challenging to do it following a vegan pattern, but it absolutely can be done. There are even now cookbooks and experts on this topic. So this is fantastic, because no matter what dietary, I like to tell people I'm nutritionally pro-choice, so I just want you to have the right information so that you can make your own choices with the right information. So you can, ketosis is not about plants and animals. It is about insulin levels. So anybody, no matter what dietary pattern you follow, if you follow a pattern that lowers your insulin levels, that is going to bring you into ketosis, and that's going to bring you those energy benefits. You might be challenged to get all the nutrients you need, and you really will need to supplement carefully, but you can absolutely get the benefits of ketosis.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And there's also a question about, can you, let me see where I've got it, otherwise I'd know it from the top of my head. What's the link between the state of the microbiome and brain health?
It's a very, very important and exciting field. The microbiome is really important. All the trillions of bacteria that live in our gut, they're communicating with the brain through different pathways, through the nervous system, through hormones, through immune system molecules and chemical messengers, lots of different ways that the brain communicates with the gut. And we know that we know it's very important, and we know that they talk to each other. And we also know that what you eat changes your microbiome within less than 24 hours. Mm-hmm. You can see dramatic changes to your microbiome because the bacteria are dividing and dying and reproducing so rapidly that they have very short lives. So within 24 hours, you can see some bacteria multiply and some die off or diminish just based on the food you're eating, if they like the food or not. So, but unfortunately, that's really all we know. We do not know yet how best to feed the microbiome to either keep it healthy or restore it to health. There's no good science on that yet. Lots of guessing going on, and lots of recommendations that are premature, that are not based in science. It's very important to keep that in mind, because when you see headlines like, oh, you need to eat this huge variety of fruits and vegetables to keep your microbiome healthy, or you need to eat a very high fiber diet to feed your microbiome, we don't have that level of information available to us yet.
Just looking at Ben. Can I do another question? Yes. Thank you so much. I have Mireille here. She says, I have bipolar disorder with rapid cycling, but since I started the ketogenic lifestyle and eating no more than 30 carbs per day since this February, I have eliminated most episodes already. And what is your experience in the necessity of staying in ketosis with bipolar patients? And do patients have to stay on these 30 grams of carbs per day their whole life? Or is it possible to achieve more flexibility?
This is a really common question. First of all, congratulations on discovering the diet and making these changes for yourself. I'm really, really happy for you. And some of the science of ketogenic diets specifically for psychiatric disorders is very new, but the area where it's the strongest is really bipolar disorder. There's a lot of wonderful science coming out on ketogenic diets and bipolar disorder, lots of studies going on in different places around the world, including especially perhaps the University of Edinburgh, where Dr. Ian Campbell, who put his own bipolar disorder into sustained remission over 7 years ago now, using a ketogenic diet. And that's what inspired him to study this and become a researcher in this. So you're not alone. But how long do you need to stay on the diet? Do you need to stay on it forever? What happens if you stop the diet? This probably varies from person to person. We don't have enough information yet, enough research to be able to tell you for sure whether you have to stay on this diet for the rest of your life or not. But I can tell you, at least from working with adults, that I have not yet seen anybody who is able to stop the diet permanently and maintain results. Most of my patients, when they take a break from the diet, either accidentally or on purpose, they see their symptoms come back pretty quickly. And this is also true of Dr. Ian Campbell, whose story is in the book, so you can read about his experience and what he noticed. The other thing I would say about that is there may be the possibility that you could stop the diet after a period of time if enough brain healing takes place. And we know this happens in children with epilepsy, that in children with epilepsy, because we've been, the ketogenic diet's been used to help children and adults with epilepsy. It's been used in epilepsy now for over 100 years. So we know from lots and lots of experience, not me personally, but colleagues, through working using ketogenic diets in children with epilepsy, is that in many cases, children just need to stay on the diet for a year or two, and then they are able to completely stop the diet and go back to eating so-called normally, and the seizures never return. So that suggests that a certain amount of healing has taken place. Now, whether that's only possible in young people, whether that's only about epilepsy and bipolar disorder, very similar. So it might depend on how old you are. It might depend on how metabolically healthy you are in other ways. But there may be that might be a possibility for you. I wouldn't say it definitely is not. I would say we really don't know. So you'd have to discover that for yourself.
Yes. And that's another question that keeps coming up. How long can you follow ketogenic diet?
There is absolutely no biological reason to believe that you shouldn't be able to stay on a ketogenic diet for the rest of your life, as long as you've constructed it properly.
Great. So no big dangers on the long term.
No.
Okay. Let's see. Do you have any questions from the audience, from the chat, or shall I just pick the next one?
There was a question about food and nutrition, whether you would make a difference if you are more looking at diabetes or more looking at brain health. Would you require a high level of ketones or a lower level of ketones? Is there something to say about that?
Yeah, so the it's a really common question is how high do the ketones need to be? And again, this varies from person to person. So I have some patients who don't even really need to be in ketosis at all. They just need to keep their glucose and insulin levels in a healthy range. Then they can safely use and burn glucose and their brain will work well. They get good benefits just from eating a very liberal, low carbohydrate diet, even if they're not in ketosis most of the time. And then I have other patients where it's the opposite, where they have to have their ketones in a very specific range in order to feel well. And sometimes you'll see this in people who have a lot of metabolic damage over the years, or people with more serious psychiatric conditions, like bipolar disorder, like Alzheimer's disease. We see a very strong relationship in the early research with bipolar disorder, for example, that the higher the ketones are, the better people feel. And now, to a point, you don't want them so high that you're in the starvation range. You want kind of nice, moderate ketogenic range, maybe somewhere between 1.0 millimole, 1.5 millimole, and say about 3 millimole on the blood meter. You can talk about blood measurements. So some people really need a very specific range, and other people are not so sensitive to that.
Yep, good. One other question that keeps popping up is, what's the effect of hormones and the menopause on mental health?
59-year-old woman here, so I have a lot of personal experience with this. So I noticed that for myself, my metabolism was changing as I was going entering into my 50s, even though my diet wasn't, I was already eating a ketogenic diet and very few plants and all of that. And I noticed my metabolism really changing when I came into my 50s. No matter what I did, it was just different.
Mm, yep.
And I'm sorry. So, looking at the camera here. So I tried lots of different things, and that's when I decided to try that very strict carnivore diet, because I didn't know what else to do. I was already eating keto. I was already keeping my plant foods down. I was exercising, all the things you're supposed to do. But I felt terrible, and I was gaining weight, and my migraines were coming back. And so So that's why I did the carnivore diet, and it worked beautifully, but it was very difficult to sustain. And the other, so I broadened my diet a little bit more after a while. Now, the other thing, though, I would say about menopause, so a few facts. So when you go through menopause, many hormones are changing, but the ones that are coming down most importantly are estrogen and growth hormone. And so this makes, for some people, I think for many women, considering estrogen replacement can be very useful. Estrogen is required for, it plays a very important role in healthy metabolism, including insulin sensitivity and gut health and joint health and bone health and brain health. There are estrogen receptors throughout the body and brain for a reason. So you don't need a lot of estrogen. You don't need to have cycles, but you do need to have a little bit to maintain the health of your tissues. And many people will be good candidates for this, but not all. I can't advise everybody to do this. So see somebody and talk to them about it. But it made a tremendous difference for me personally. So I know that there wasn't anything else that I was able nothing else helped me as much as that did. So there's a very real hormonal shift that's taking place that may need to be addressed with hormone replacement. But if you're not already eating a ketogenic diet, if you've never tried that before and you're going through menopause, it's a wonderful tool. A really powerful lever you can pull is cleaning up your diet in all these, you know, ways that are described in the book that we've already talked about. You need to buy the book to know these things. And clean up your diet and get those glucose and insulin levels under control. Test yourself for insulin resistance. There are a few very easy ways to do this. Some that you can even do at home without a doctor or a blood test. For example, you measure your waist circumference. If it's less than half your height, if it's more than half your height, then you probably have some degree of insulin resistance. Look at your cholesterol panel. Are your triglycerides too high? Is your blood sugar too high? Get a fasting insulin level. Is your fasting insulin level too high? Lots of different things you can do to test yourself. And if you have insulin resistance, you've got to get those insulin levels down.
Okay, great. And there's one last question here from Lisbeth, who wants to know, do you eat any vegetables yourself? And if so, which?
I do eat a few. I'm always kind of playing with what I eat. But for a very long time now, there have been some plant foods that have always agreed quite well with me. These include things like cucumbers and zucchini and olives and mushrooms and these are lettuce. You know, there are some plant foods I do very well with. Others
we call them courgettes.
Courgettes.
Yeah. So, and I don't do well with seeds and nuts and certain very fibrous vegetables. Too much cruciferous vegetables can be a problem, and the green beans and things like that. But that's me. I don't mean to say that everybody will have problems.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
And I think that's nice. We talked about it in the book. Also talks about a quiet keto or quiet paleo. It's really what are the things that you can do that you can experiment with. You know, this is not a one size fits all. This has to be for everyone.
Right.
But I think what really got me excited about reading the book is both fact-based, how you make the science understandable and clear, and also in the suggestions on your diet, where you make it really a discovery journey and say, hey, try this, these are the things that you can consider and see how far you want to go and how far you need to go. Are there more questions?
Loads, but how much time do we have?
Well, I think we can take two more.
Okay, this is a short one, but probably a long answer. Carla wants to know, can nutrition or can food trigger a psychosis?
Oh, it's interesting. Yes, I can. So there are some documented reports in the literature of, for example, when the blood sugar goes up too high, seeing symptoms of psychosis. And there are also well-documented cases in the literature of diets containing wheat causing psychosis, and removing the wheat from the diet completely resolving the psychosis. So those are a couple of good examples of things that we shouldn't eat anyway, sugar and wheat, which have been documented to stimulate psychotic symptoms.
Okay, good. One more.
Last one then.
One last one.
So two, right?
Oh dear, I have to pick one. Yes, that's a good one. I saw one question, I can't find it right now, but there was someone wanting to know, I really love to try the ketogenic diet or to do something with my nutrition for my brain health. But I keep bumping into obstacles with my doctors, with my in the hospitals. What can we do to change this?
Oh, I know. It really is a very serious problem, is that most physicians, and including myself, we weren't taught anything about nutrition in medical school residency. So in medical school, 4 years of medical school, we had 2 or 3 hours worth of nutrition education, and most of what we learned was wrong. And then 4 years of psychiatry training, we didn't talk about food once. So the last person you want nutrition advice from is the doctor.
Sorry, I don't understand.
Ben has trouble.
You study psychiatry, it's everything about the brain, and you don't look at the fuel that the brain needs in a... Is that true?
That's 100% true.
Okay. I find that... disturbing.
Yes.
All of us who do this work, there's a small but growing number of psychiatric practitioners who practice this way. All of us had to learn this on our own. We were not taught this in school. So, and I think that's going to change very quickly as the research is really exploding in this area. Right now, still, most conventionally trained clinicians, doctors and other types of clinicians, have a lot of the wrong information, even about basic nutrition, let alone the difference between let alone metabolic health, meaning how important your keeping control of your blood sugar and insulin levels is, or even what insulin does in the body. Most doctors think of it as a blood sugar regulator, but it's actually the master growth hormone that controls the activity and levels of multiple hormone systems throughout the body, and multiple pathways. Like we were talking about, a good example is just fat burning. Too much insulin can't burn fat. Doesn't everybody want to burn fat? Lower insulin, you turn fat burning on. I mean, too much insulin, you make fat. Not enough insulin, you burn fat.
So
it's
will you be teaching? Will you be teaching nutrition in the psychiatry curriculum?
From your mouth to God's ears, I would love to do that. Are you offering me a job?
Well, I think you need to teach it at Harvard, since that's where the best training, best people come from. So I think we need to round off, right, in terms of time. If we've tried to answer all your questions, if you feel your question has not been answered, please send us an email. And Georgia is here for another few days, so we'll try and answer that one by email or in different ways. Before I go and give a big hug to Georgia, there's a couple of people that I want to mention, I want to thank. First of all, Louisette, I think you're a beacon in Holland on everything on keto. You're helping getting the right message out. You're helping teach people, both practitioners as well as the average consumer, of what keto is about, and also debunking a lot of the myths and a lot of the scary things, oh, it's whatever. So there were lots of questions about keto, which we'll try and answer as well. And we'll probably need to do another webinar together.
Sure, let's talk about this.
You can't see this, but in the audience, there's some very special people. There is Eline de Keister from the Leiden University, and they're about to start a research project into keto or into nutrition and autism, which is going to be happening, and we're looking at supporting that. And that brings me to Susie is also here in the audience, who is the backup, the support,
the rock,
Georgia, the rock, making sure that everything happens. Susie, wonderful that you're here, and thank you so much for guiding Georgia and supporting Georgia all the way through. Because I know that without you, the book wouldn't have been here. She wouldn't have been here. So we're extremely grateful. I know that you're the person behind the scenes, but a special thank you to you as well. And then Georgia, really an amazing thank you from Louisette, from me, from the entire audience, because your book has opened up so many minds, has created so much clarity in this world where there's so much confusion, and I can only recommend it. If you want to read the book in Dutch, it's going to be launched on Wednesday. We'll send the link in the meeting notes where you can order it. It's brought out by Lucht, which is the uitgever. It's called Heal Your Hoofd, right?
Yes.
Heal Your Hoofd, so heal your head, but also your whole head. So that's really what it's all about. And Georgia, an amazing thank you for making all the way from beautiful Cambridge, Massachusetts, all the way to Holland. I hope the weather has been okay for you. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Ben, for making this all possible, for bringing people together, for being the connector here and the facilitator. And I'm really impressed by your enthusiasm and your passion for the topics that we're talking about here today. So thank you very much as well.
Yes, and thank you for making Keto Diet Guides easier and more delicious for
people. Yes.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Dankjewel voor het luisteren naar deze special edition. Ik hoop dat het je nieuwe inzichten heeft gebracht. Zoals je hoorde, noemde ik de nieuwe scholing speciaal voor professionals in de GGZ die willen leren hoe een ketogeen dieet kan werken voor hun cliënten. Dit is de scholing Metabol en Mentaal Gezond die ik samen met Nicole Laurent heb ontwikkeld en met hulp van GGZ-psycholoog en psychotherapeut Lita Jousma. Ik ben heel blij te kunnen vertellen dat we inmiddels de eerste groep hebben afgerond. Deelnemers waren onder andere psychiaters, een psycholoog, arts en een specialistisch begeleider in de GGZ. En binnenkort beginnen we met een nieuwe ronde. Op 8 september 2025 gaan we van start. Op het moment dat deze podcast uitkomt, zijn er nog enkele plaatsen beschikbaar. Deze scholing gaat definitief van start. Kies of je erbij bent. De link staat bij deze podcast. Nogmaals bedankt voor het luisteren. En graag tot de volgende keer.